This is CD 4 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 4 titled Karma Yoga.
Namaste. I have been born many times, Arjuna, and many times hast thou been born, but I remember my past lives, and thou hast forgotten thine. That line, by way of review of our last discussion, which concerned the matter of reincarnation, which is Krishna's first presentation to Arjuna of the beginning of the seeds of what is called the higher wisdom, or giving him a perspective about exactly what dance he thinks he's playing, which means us. Now Krishna begins to throw out to Arjuna. Arjuna is faced, as we've all realized, with this conflict. And Krishna starts to throw out to Arjuna a number of alternative justifications for why he should get on with it, why he should get into the struggle of the spirit versus the worldly, or dharma and adharma, or the battle of Kurukshetra. And one of the arguments that he just throws away in two shlokas, which is one that you would give to a materialist, really, of somebody very worldly, he says, "For all things born in truth must die, and out of truth, out of death, in truth comes life. Face to face with what must be, cease thou from sorrow." But if he were born again and again, and again and again he were to die, even then, victorious man, cease thou from sorrow. Meaning, look, you're going to die whether you like it or not, and so are all those people on the other side. So what are you getting so freaked about? It's all inevitable. It's all in the cards. Death definitely follows birth. It's the way the game's designed. So don't get so upset about it. That argument doesn't do much for Arjuna. And it's, as I say, just put in lightly. Now, Krishna then starts to deal with a fallacy that is common at the time. It was a very strong cultural belief at the time, because there was a philosophy called Sankhya philosophy. And Sankhya philosophy separated what was called Purusha and Prakriti. And Purusha was the inactive, and Prakriti was the active. And they really had very little to do with one another. The inactive was always inactive, and the active was always active. And the game in Sankhya philosophy was to get out of the active and into the inactive. And the highest goal of Sankhya philosophy was to do nothing, was to just not act. And Krishna says, "Not by refraining from action does man attain freedom from action. For not even for a moment can a man be without action. Helplessly are all driven to action by the forces born of nature. He who withdraws himself from actions, but ponders on their pleasures in his heart, he is under a delusion and is a false follower of the path." Now that last one sneaks in another thought, which all of us are very intimately familiar with. That's, for example, the one of, "I'm brahmachari, I don't have sex." And then, "I'm not having sex, I haven't had sex all day." It's like giving up smoking, you know. If you know when you meet somebody who's given up smoking, that's really who they are. Who are you? I am somebody who's given up smoking for 2 weeks, 4 hours, and 32 minutes at this point. And their thought forms, they are practically smoking a pack an hour in terms of the thought and the karma they're creating. But that's sneaking that in, and we're going to talk about that later. The main point here is that Krishna is saying to Arjuna, you're not going to get out of this. See, Arjuna said, I'm not going to fight. And he threw down his bow, and Krishna said, tough, you're not going to get away with it that easy. Because that philosophy is a fallacy. Because you're going to do something, and whatever you're going to do is going to have karma connected with it. And then he proceeds to explain to Arjuna, at the level that Arjuna can hear it, because Arjuna is a kshatriya, he's a warrior, he's a doer, he's an actor, he's a really good guy doer. And he's explaining at the level he can understand it, he says, do your duty. Do your duty. Do what you're supposed to do. Take your part in it. Play your part. And these shlokas. Think thou also of thy duty, and do not waver. There is no greater good for a warrior than to fight in a righteous war. There is a war that opens the door to heaven, Arjuna. Happy the warriors whose fate is to fight such a war. We are here at Naropa involved in the war that opens the doors to heaven. It's the inner war each of us is going through. Happy the warrior, it's our grace that we are able to fight this battle. But to forego this fight for righteousness is to forego thy duty and honor. Now he's starting to talk about the concept of dharma. And the word dharma means so many different things, but here let's just limit it to the very traditional cultural use in Hinduism, meaning your duty. It's your dharma. He's a kshatriya and kshatriyas fight. To not do it is to fall into transgression. And then he says, if you don't do your duty, then you watch, it's all going to turn terrible. Men will tell of thy dishonor both now and in times to come. And to a man who is in honor, dishonor is more than death. The great warriors will say that thou hast run from the battle through fear. And those who thought great things of thee will speak of thee in scorn. And thine enemies will speak of thee in contemptuous words of ill will and derision, pouring scorn upon thy courage. Can there be for a warrior a more shameful fate? In death, thy glory in heaven, in victory, thy glory on earth. Arise, therefore, Arjuna, with thy soul ready to fight. And in chapter 3, do thy duty, even if it be humble, rather than another's, even if it be great. To die in one's duty is life. To live in another's is death. Now, in the Hindu tradition, there are, as you know, the castes, of which the Kshatriya is a caste. This is a division of the society, and originally these divisions were brought down through consciousness by the rishis, and later on we'll talk about when those things were harmonious, and how, as man fell out of the spirit, they became disharmonious. Man and woman fell out of the spirit. And also in India, there are the ashramas, or stages of life. There is the period of 0 to 20 when you're a child and then a student, 20 to 40 when you're a householder, 40 to 60 when you go out to study and make pilgrimages, do religious study, and 60 to 80 when you become a sannyas. You renounce everything. You renounce all worldly things and all spiritual things, and you become a renunciate. And these are formal structures. Now, theoretically, if you were a kshatriya at a certain age, there would be a very clearly defined Vedic prescription for what exactly you should be doing today. Just an absolutely clear structure. It's like a grid that's been defined for appropriate action. And Krishna is saying to Arjuna, do what is appropriate. Now, we in this country are faced with considerable confusion about that. Because it isn't clear what we're supposed to be doing at any moment. There aren't clear cultural prescriptions that are deeply ingrained in the society. There are some rough ones, but they're being thrown about pretty loosely. What our dharma is, how our individual differences determine what is our suitable duty at the moment. I think you begin to get a sense that when you've got a husband or a wife and you've got a baby, that defines certain limiting conditions or certain possibilities. That if you have certain intellect or certain economics, you have certain possibilities. That if you're rich, that defines in part your dharma. You can't make believe you're not rich. And throwing it away isn't going to get rid of it. That was a karmic act. And you begin to have to be responsible about your money. That becomes your dharma at that point. And what Krishna is saying is, the game only works if everybody does their dharma, so do yours. And that is familiar to you, those of you that are familiar with the Bible, from Paul, Romans 12. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, whether prophecy, let us prophesy according to the proportion of faith, or ministry, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation, he that giveth, let him do it with simplicity, he that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. Like what your part is, play it. Just play it. Right? Do your duty. And that's the lowest level of the concept of dharma. Find out what your little square in the grid is and then do it perfectly. Why you're going to do it remains to be seen. We're going to be discussing that. But this part of it is Krishna is saying, just do it. Now, as you go to look at your sadhana, you'll find that there are certain forms of spiritual practice that are right on for you and others that aren't. I had the most peculiar, and I've struggled with it all these years, that when I got into, quote, the spiritual trip, unquote, I came out of an intellectual tradition, and because I was an intellectual of sorts, I got very attached to the meditative practices because they were so essency. They were so clean, especially the Theravadan Buddhist. It was so neat and exquisitely simple, and my mind was just thrilled by the Abhidhamma and things like that. Because it was all beautiful category systems and so simple and intellectually exquisite. And I went and meditated. And I meditated and I meditated. And I got to a certain plateau. And then I started to experience that my heart had gotten very dry. But I said to myself, mind moments flickering by, I said in this mind moment, I said, well, you're just copping out. What do you mean, heart dry? What's all that about? But then I said to myself, well, at the stage you're at, apparently you need to open your heart. So go get it over with. It's like go to the toilet. You know? And at that point I went off to a huge Shiva festival in Delhi after 2 months of meditating. But before I did, I had arranged with this very, very essence meditation teacher who I knew was going to this beautiful little mountain village for the summer, for the monsoon, that I could go and sit with him for 2 months. This was going to be my chance to really meditate, because there were only going to be... I went up in advance, and I rented a house, and I had a new roof put on it, and it was a new water system. There was only room for four of us in the house. So there were just going to be four of us with the essence meditation teacher. Can you imagine that? And I thought, I'm really going to do it now, because that'll push me, because he'll be right there and every day, and I'll just have to meditate. And that'll be good for me. You see, I was in the good for me place. You're bad, right? You're bad, you don't want to meditate, because meditation's good, right? I mean, you got to hear that space, because all I was bringing was my whole Judeo-Christian trip to bear on this new space. And when I came to my guru in Allahabad, I said, Maharaji, I've been meditating, and I've got this meditation teacher, and I've rented this house, and I'm going to meditate for... And I looked at him like, aren't I good? It's just like, you know, with your parent, don't I deserve a pellet for that? And he looked at me and he said, if you desire... Now, that's a tricky one, see? Those of you that have read the Gita already know, that's like the kiss of death, you know. If you desire, if you're on an ego trip, go ahead, baby. Go ahead, do your meditation, go ahead. Okay. There's Mr. Bhakti himself. Sure, you want to meditate? Good. Fine, go ahead. You desire a meditation? Go ahead, do. Good. And I thought, well, I don't care whether he likes it or not, I'm going to do it anyway, all right? Because my attachment to doing it was so strong, because all the big boys meditate. They, I mean, you know, those that can't meditate sing. Right? I mean, that was the space my head was in, all right? I mean, I had a very clear value, very clear hierarchy. So the time came, and I came to this village, and we settled in, and we got our food, and we were all, it was so exquisite, it was so precious, you know. And we got it going, and the teacher was to arrive on Friday, this was about Monday. And between Monday and Friday, about 20 other Westerners appeared in the town, which was ruining the whole vibration of the place, you know. And they were moving in all the houses and hotels around the place, and when I'd say, what are you doing here? They'd say, Maharaji sent us. Yeah, he said, go be with Ram Dass. And then on Friday, a letter arrives from the teacher saying, unfortunately, due to some dealings with the government, I will be unable to come there this summer. I wish you luck in your meditation. So I was left with 20, 25 Westerners, and we ended up having an ashram, and I was like did the abbot trip again. And it was turned into a devotional, beautiful, exquisite devotional, gentle meditational, very warm. We read the Ramayana all the time. The end, when I went back to Maharaji, I approached him, he says, ah, Ram Dass, you had a lot of students this summer. Yes, Maharaji. Teacher didn't come. Buddhist teacher didn't come. No, Maharaji. Now, after a while, how much can you struggle, you know? You just surrender. You just say, well, okay, I give up. Like I'd say to Maharaji, look, just you and I are here now. Would you tell me, how do I raise my kundalini? I figured he'd give me some, you know, inner thing, you know, like he'd say, well, now you meditate on the bloop. And he said, feed everybody. Feed everybody? Feed everybody, serve everybody. Maharaji, to raise my kundalini, feed everybody, serve everybody. He says, the kundalini can be raised with the touch of a guru. The guru can just think about it and your kundalini will raise. Don't worry about it, just feed people. What he was saying to me was, do your dharma. What has become clear is that my yoga is devotion and service. And it's yoga and devotion and service whether I like it or not. Which is Arjuna's predicament. He didn't like it. And finally, you hear what your root is, and you start to surrender into your dharma. Okay? Okay, that's what Arjuna is being advised to do. And Krishna is saying to him, don't get so upset about it, though, because really, you're not doing it anyway. Right? He says, all actions take place in time, but the man lost in selfish delusion thinks that he himself is the actor. But the man who knows the relation between the forces of nature and actions sees how some forces of nature work upon other forces of nature, and he becomes not their slave. Even a wise man will act under the impulse of his nature. All beings follow nature. Of what use is restraint? That is, your body and your personality, your mind, all that lower stuff, that's all part of nature. It's all just lawful stuff. What are you getting so uptight about? Just let it be harmonious with its lawful manifestation. Don't struggle against it so hard. Thus is the wheel of law set in motion, and that man lives indeed in vain who in a sinful life of pleasure helps not its revolution. Now that's another idea we're going to be coming to, but the general drift is that when you're doing your dharma, you are part of Christ's body. You are part of the flow. But the man who has found the joy of the spirit and in the spirit has satisfaction, that man is beyond the law of action. He is beyond what is done and beyond what is not done, and in all his works he is beyond the help of mortal beings. We are now starting to approach another concept. Plotinus says, murders, death in all its shapes, the capture and sacking of towns, all must be considered as so much stage show, so many shiftings of scenes, the horror and outcry of a play. For here too, in all the changing doom of life, it is not the true man, the inner soul, that grieves or laments, but merely the phantasm of the man, the outer man, playing his part on the boards of the world. And those of you that have read Hermann Hesse, in Journey to the East, you will recall the talk in the park when Leo says, naturally, one can do all kinds of other things with life, make a duty of it, or a battleground, or a prison, but that doesn't make it any prettier. Just what life is when it is beautiful and happy, it's a game. It's an exquisite design of which we play a part. And Meister Eckhart, who says, we ought to take everything God puts on us evenly, not comparing and wondering which is more important or higher or best. We ought simply to follow where God leads, that is, to do what we are most inclined to do, to go where we are repeatedly admonished to go, to where we feel most drawn, where we feel most drawn. And that's the instruction that in the West, to hear your dharma, you have to start to listen. You have to start to listen to what part of Christ's body you are, what part you're playing in the dance. And when you understand the exquisiteness of the design and start to develop that wisdom allows you to realize that no part is any better or worse than any other part. It's just different than every other part. And that each person plays their part perfectly. Not greedily wishing they could get onto somebody else's part. And in the little villages that I visit in India, where the Dharma is still extant, where people are still living in the Dharma, you find the sweeper who is making 2 rupees a day totally fulfilled to be the perfect sweeper. He's not even saying, look what a good sweeper I am. He's just sweeping perfectly. And he's expecting the king to be the perfect king. He's not, or Indira Gandhi to be the perfect prime minister. He's not wishing he were Indira Gandhi. Each of them is accepting their dharma. Around those people, I often feel a kind of contentment that isn't very available here in the West. A kind of a quietness inside. So what is happening now is that Arjuna is beginning to recognize the laws of nature of which he's a part. He's beginning to recognize the wheel of karma that is all lawfully playing out and that he's merely a part of it. He's beginning to understand what in Chinese philosophy is called the Tao, the harmony of nature. This is only the beginning of the wisdom. It's only the beginning part. But it's an important part, and it's the part that Arjuna is being impelled to do his duty with just that little bit of knowledge. And he's being suggested, do it more impersonally. Don't get so caught. Don't get so personally involved in your melodrama. See, everybody here has a melodrama. Everybody thinks there's somebody doing something. I've come to Naropa. Or whatever your thing is. You know, I gotta have sex tonight or I'll die. I'm feeling nauseous. Why don't I understand more? I can't meditate. I'm so high. And the tendency is to get so deeply involved in your own melodrama, you keep thinking you're the actor. You keep thinking you're doing it. And really, that's all just lawful stuff running off. You're just watching nature. It's far out, isn't it? Sometimes it's good to take a seed and put it in a bit of earth and put it in your kitchen and watch it grow into a flower. Just watch it every day and then use it as a meditation exercise and then study yourself in the same way you study the seed growing. Until you see the laws of nature working in you. You see what leads to anger and what leads to this. You just watch it all. Don't judge it. Just watch it. Now, with all that preparation, we're now ready for what is the, would appear to be the major theme, but is really a sort of a minor major theme of the Gita, which is the theme of Karma Yoga. Let me read you some shlokas to bring it to mind for you. But great is the man who, free from attachments, and with a mind ruling its powers in harmony, works on the path of karma yoga. In liberty from the bonds of attachment, do thou therefore the work to be done. For the man whose work is pure attains indeed the supreme. We're hearing, do your work, but do it without attachment. We're hearing a definition of karma yoga. We're not yet hearing how to not be attached, but we're hearing how to do karma yoga. Set thy heart upon thy work, but never on its reward. Work not for reward, but never cease to do thy work. That means don't be so future-oriented. Don't do this for that, even though you may plan to do this in relation to that. And in regard to that, Mahatma Gandhi said it very clearly, I think. He said, in regard to every action, one must know the result that is expected to follow, the means thereto, how to get there, and the capacity for it. He who being thus equipped is without desire for the result and is yet wholly engrossed in the due fulfillment of the task before him. Such a man is said to have renounced the fruits of his action. Now, for many of us, this seems very contradictory. People say to you, if you're living in the present moment, how can you think about the results of your acts? That's how it all works, where it's going to lead to, how it all comes out at this moment. And then out of all that comes the decision to do something, and then you do it. But when you're doing it, you're not doing it with half of your mind waiting to see how it comes out or trying to get the payoff. You're doing it. Then what happens will happen. But when you're doing it, you're doing it. But it's very subtle, because even when you're doing it, there is an awareness of the entire field when you're quiet enough. And who else has said something useful about this is Don Juan in the Castaneda books, in talking about the warrior, because the warrior is the perfect karma yogi. If you want to review the Don Juan books, you'll see all the things he says about the warrior refer to the karma yogi. A warrior is a hunter. He calculates everything. That's control. But once his calculations are over, he acts. He lets go. And he survives in the best of all possible fashions. The mood of a warrior calls for control over himself, and at the same time it calls for abandoning himself. And you're going to see more and more as we get into purification exercises how that those two processes work in us. He realizes nobody's doing anything to anybody, much less to a warrior. Do thy work in the peace of yoga and free from selfish desires. Be not moved in success or in failure. Yoga is evenness of mind, a peace that is ever the same. Now, I'll agree to do something like give a lecture, and I will go with a model in my head about how that's supposed to be. And I'll give that lecture, and it won't be anything like my model. And the lecture is a disaster. Everybody gets up and walks out, which for a lecture is hard, if you're concerned about the fruits of your actions. And that will burn into me, and I will go away humiliated, shaken, ego crushed. And slowly that humiliation and ego crush and hurt will keep working on me and working on me and working on me. Until after a while I begin to realize, just like bad acid trips, these were the greatest teachings. Far out. They were showing me how I was clinging to my model of what I thought a good outcome would be. See, because there was a lot of time, and I'm still caught in it, as you may subtly recognize, some of you, I'm caught in loving people to love me. The problem is when somebody loves you, they get dependent on you. And then they're not being thrown back on themselves. So if I'm really lousy, I may be doing the optimum thing for you. Right? In other words, I can't stand back far enough often because of my own ego needs to see what would be the optimum outcome of my own acts. So that I've gotten to the point where I do what I do, and how it comes out, well, that's interesting. Isn't that far out how that came out? It's like this winter, we decided to do an evening at Winterland in San Francisco. We decided to do Winterland, right? Those of you that know, that's a big rock and roll emporium where they have the circus. Seats 6,000 people, and Bhagwan Das and Amazing Grace and me, we were just going to do Winterland, right? With slides, with Rameshwar Das running slides on the screen. And cost us $4,500 to put together this operation, the advertising and the whole business, right? And we did it. Boy, was it far. It went from 2 in the afternoon till 8 the next morning. I mean, we were going to do Winterland, right? The next morning, when we counted up the receipts, it turned out that only about 2,000 people had come. And we found out we had lost about $1,100. While all of us had had fascinating fantasies of red Volvos and trips to Mexico and all the things we would do with all the money we were going to make from this incredible thing we were going to put on, right? And we sat, we had been up all night long, and we sat counting the money in the living room, right? right? Now it's around 9 o'clock in the morning, and we're counting, and you run out of money, but you haven't run out of debts. See, we're still paying off, and all of our lives are now going to change incredibly because we've just bombed, right? And we all sat there, and I said to everybody, do you feel bad about it? And nobody could find in themselves that they felt bad about it. It was bizarre. It was as if, in spite of the fact that our whole expectation had been disconfirmed, right, okay. And how it had been was how it was, and how it is, and how it is. Now we have an $1,100 debt. That's who we are, right? And before we were having the perfection of the moment at Winterland, and that's how it was. After we finished blaming each other. And such learning experiences are priceless. They're very rich experiences. To teach you not to cling, to don't cling. You set up a game and then you play it purely and lovingly and compassionately and with involvement as pure karma yoga. And then how it comes out is how it comes out. And that's the next conditions for the next dance, at the next mind moment. For work done for reward is much lower than work done in the yoga of wisdom. Seek salvation in the wisdom of reason. How poor those who work for a reward. In this wisdom, a man goes beyond what is well done and what is not well done. Go there, thou therefore, to wisdom. Yoga is wisdom in work. He whose undertakings are free from anxious desire. Free from anxious desire. And fanciful thought. And fanciful thought. Whose work is made pure in the fire of wisdom. He is called wise by those who see. I am not doing any work, thinks the man who is in harmony, who sees the truth. For in seeing or hearing, smelling or touching, in eating or walking, or sleeping or breathing, in talking or grasping or relaxing, and even in opening or closing his eyes, he remembers, it is the servants of my soul that are working. It's just nature running off. It's just stuff happening. The yogi works for the purification of his soul. He throws off selfish attachment. It is only his body or his senses or his mind or his reason that works. It's not you. Right? It's not you. It's just your body. It's just your senses. It's just your mind. It's just your reason. It's not you. You hear the wisdom that's being suggested here? What they keep saying, wisdom? What is that wisdom? The wisdom is you aren't who you think you are. Who you think you are is acting, is doing, is collecting, is worried about the reward, and you aren't that one at all. The man of harmony surrenders the reward of his work and attains final peace. The man of disharmony, urged by desire, is attached to his reward and remains in bondage. The ruler of his soul surrenders in mind all work and rests in the joy of quietness in the castle of nine gates, the body. Gurdjieff said, if you can serve a cup of tea right, you can do anything. If you can perform any act in a true karma yogic fashion, now let's look at the word karma yoga. Karma, we've talked about, it means the lawful relationship among things. And each of you has your karma, your lawful predicament at this moment. Yoga is the vehicle, is means union or coming to union. So what we're talking about is the method, now we're talking about a method, of using work using what you do every day to come to union. And the way you do that is by hearing what your karma is and becoming harmonious with it. That is doing your dharma. That is the optimum thing you can do at any moment to bring you to union. Now we're talking about karma yoga as a method, work as a method, which is what the stage that I'm at and many, I assume, are at in this hall. In the Tao, the Book of Tao, it says, by letting it go, it all gets done. The world is won by those who let it go. But when you try and try, the world is then beyond the winning. Because when you're trying to make a cup of tea right, you're not making a cup of tea right. The way you make a cup of tea right is you get everything you need to make the tea, including knowing how to make the tea, and then you make the tea. And when you're making the tea, you're making the tea. You're not worried about how it'll come out, or wondering whether you're good enough to make the tea, or you're not thinking about the philosophy of tea drinking. Okay. Now, there is a meditation called the tea ceremony, which I understand will be taught here next semester. That's different. That's a philosophical meditation exercise. But it's like, when you're doing it, do it. Intuit what is the harmonious next act, and then when you're doing it, do it. Then, when it's done, a whole new set of conditions will exist, and then you intuit where you're at then, and then you decide what to do, and then you do it. And the purer you feel your karmic predicament and flow into it, the more it becomes without self-consciousness. Without self-consciousness. This is all very low-level karma yoga, but it's still the beginning of the game. He who sees the inaction that is inaction and the action that is in inaction is wise indeed. Even when he is engaged in action, he remains poised in the tranquility of the Atman. See, we start from where we're at. Here we are, we have desires. We're confused. Most of the things we're doing because we want something out of them. And you can't make believe you're other than you are. You start from where you are, and you take the next act you're going to do, and you say, well, how will I do it? And you intuit. At this moment, does it feel like what I'm about to do seems like the right thing to do? No matter where that intuition comes from, if it seems okay, realize it's not going to be a pure message from the beyond. It'll just be who you are. Okay, it feels okay to go to Naropa for the summer. Okay, now you're at Naropa. Now be here. Don't spend all the time you're at Naropa deciding whether you should have come. You're at Naropa, be at Naropa. Then when you're done with Naropa, you can sit around and say, was it worth it? That's different. But while you're here, be here. It's like when you're making love, make love. If you decide to go out and get drunk, go out and get drunk. Righteously. You know? It's like begin to trust your own. Don't sit and keep ruining everything all the time by that self-conscious, judgmental holding back, because then your mind is going in and out all the time. It's the old superego that's so afraid of blowing it, so afraid of making a mistake, of looking like a fool, of having appeared the wrong way to yourself, externalized inward, looking at yourself from outside in. You sense the rightness of something from whatever trivial level you're working from. And then you leap. And when you're leaping, you don't sit around wondering, should you have done it? You leap. You get ready, you go to the end of the diving board, and then you dive. And when you're diving, you don't start pulling back from the water. You dive. You do the perfect dive, as perfect as you can do. That's the first level of karma yoga. The first level of karma yoga is to hear how, in fact, your body and your senses and your mind, including your reason, are all part of karma, the laws of nature and how they're unwinding, and beginning to honor the law so that you begin to see yourself as you thought yourself to be, as part of the law. Now, where are you looking at it from? You're looking at it from within the law, of course. But slowly, 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 there is a hole in the whole thing, in the fabric. That quietness within, that meditative space, you are moving towards something much more interesting than anything you thought the game was about. You are extricating yourself from the turmoil of daily life, not by non-action, but by extricating yourself from being attached to the doer of the act. If you're protesting, protest. If you're loving, love. If you're drinking, drinking. If you're studying, study. Whatever feels like your dharma, do it. But don't get lost in thinking you are the doer. Realize that it is Mother Nature just doing her trip. It's the dance of Maya. It's just the laws unfolding. It's only your incredible egocentricity that makes you think you're doing it. There are levels and levels and levels, and that's what the wisdom is about, the deeper and deeper levels that we're going to be exploring about this. Let me just share with you for one moment more before we do questions. The models that Krishna puts forth for Arjuna, the models of karma yoga. Krishna says, I have no work to do in all the worlds, Arjuna, for these are mine. I have nothing to obtain because I have it all, and yet I work. Now, this is a whole other level of work. What we have been talking about is starting where we're at, with desires, with attachments, and in the desire to come to union, the desire to come to the one, the desire to quiet down, the desire to surrender, in that desire, we use that desire to determine our dharma and to do it. And we do it as a desire within the desire system. It's not without, there is an attachment in there, the attachments to getting liberated. But then the question is, when you get liberated, do you work? I mean, like, we may not know, like, I have really no profound understanding because you only see your own projections. I don't know what level of evolution, say, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is at. But let us, for the sake of argument, assume that he's a realized being. What's he doing creating Naropa Institute? I mean, is that what realized beings do? I thought they just sat around in bliss. Oh, discorporated. I mean, what's he doing all this stuff for? Giving lectures, rushing around. What is all that about? Maharaji sat for years just giving people puris and potatoes and throwing apples at them and talking to them about this and that. What is he working on himself? Must still have some work to do. Otherwise, what is he working for? Now we're touching a whole other matter. Confuse them because the Gita talks about work at two different levels. One is work as a method of coming to quietness, and the other is after quietness, then what? Because afterwards, although this isn't a justification, there's a much more profound justification. It says, in the actions of the best men, others find their rule of action. The path that a great man follows becomes a guide to the world. A guide to the world. A guide to the world. Can you imagine a person who has no personal desire to do anything? He's got it. He is it. She is it. She has no more moral motives. She's beyond good and evil. She's not trying to develop herself. She's already here. What's she doing? What is Ananda Mayama doing in India? With all those ashrams and all that service. Outwardly, her actions may seem like those of other people. But the spirit and the motives from which she does them are entirely different. And it's that spirit which is the powerful transmission. That is the calling from the beyond. That is the beginning of now the concept of the true guru. The true guru whose life becomes a statement of how it is when you're done. And the forms are merely the vehicles for calling. Because now such a being is beyond the gunas, beyond the forces of nature, no longer attached at all to body, to mind, to reason, to senses, but using them still. Meher Baba, to penetrate into the essence of all being and significance, and to release the fragrance of that inner attainment for the guidance and benefit of others by expressing in the world of forms, truth, love, purity, and beauty. This is the soul game which has any intrinsic and absolute worth. All other happenings, incidents, and attainments can in themselves have no lasting importance. Take the acts you do each day and do it consciously. Just do it fully. Don't do it so that somebody will say, "Thank you, you did a wonderful job." If that happens, fine. If they don't say it, fine. Do it because you're doing it. Learn how to make a cup of tea right. By when you're making the cup of tea, make it. Keep feeling your way into the harmony of tea making. You're surrendering into your dharma. And in that harmony starts to lie freedom. It is the disharmony that keeps capturing you at the ego level. Once you're in harmony, you'll begin to experience the freedom, and that freedom is a whole other place. Now we're talking about merging into the Brahman, which we're going to be dealing with later. I'm going to take questions now. Could we have the lights on the rest of the... There was a fellow who had a question. Yeah. Part of your predicament at this point is being aware of the processes. We are talking now about a method which is witnessing, the method of witnessing your own melodrama, if you will. And that is a method. And when you're doing that method, you do that method purely. That's different than making a cup of tea properly. See, you're not ready to make a cup of tea properly. You're ready to use making a cup of tea to examine your ways of making a cup of tea. That's what your work is at that moment. You hear what I'm saying? Later, you may be able to do the work of making a cup of tea. It's like, for example, how I lecture. Like those of you that are very sensitive, that are not completely, but really, you know, quiet and watching, you'll watch me go in and out of dozens of levels. I mean, there are times when it's just pure stuff pouring through. And there are other times when there's old Dick Albert sitting saying, "I'll really snow him with that one," you know. And I have no control over any of this. Go in and out of these planes. Did they like it? Imagine that. Imagine that one. Who the hell cares whether they like it? It's saying to itself, you know, right? And it's watching all that. And the mantras going on and all of this schmo, this stuff, levels upon levels are going on and I'm sitting with it. I'm a babysitter to this total mess inside. And that is the way in which karma yoga is at this stage of my evolution. Can you hear that? So you've got to be ready to deal with it at a very schlock level before it gets to the exquisiteness of the next plane where there's nobody around and there's just the tea being made. Right? That's where you'll be when you finish being who you thought you were. Right? Yes. Yeah, I'll repeat the question. I'll have to tell the story. He said, in a story that I told, he's confused about whether my guru was the doer or not. Did he do anything or didn't he? The story concerned a small village in India some years back. I didn't hear this story till after my guru had left his body. There was a barber in a small village, and the barber's son had gone away some 10 years earlier, had disappeared, and the barber was just preoccupied with finding his son. And in India, there are many, like 10 million wandering sadhus, dropouts thumbing around the country for God, more or less. And so every sadhu that would come through town, this little village, he'd offer him a free shave in order to sort of grill him about whether he knew had he come across the sun somewhere. And after the shave, they would say, don't worry, your son will come back. And they'd leave. And one day, apparently, Maharaji came through town, was offered a shave, and he sat down, and the barber lathered him up and started to shave him. And he had as he was shaving him, he was telling him the story about his son disappearing, and he had shaved him about halfway, and he had told the whole story. And Maharaji went like this, which meant, excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom. And he went out of the barber shop, and then about 2 minutes later, he came back in, sat down, the barber finished the shave. Maharaji said to him, don't worry, your son will come back, just like all the rest, and then left. The next day, the son arrived. And the father said, where did you come from? And the son said, it's a very strange thing. He said, I am the manager at a hotel some 200 miles from here. And yesterday I was standing behind the desk in the hotel, and in rushed this man, and he had lather on half of his face, see? And he said to me, hurry up, your father wants you, and he gave me some money for the railroad ticket, and he ran out again. So I came, right? Okay. Now, later on we're going to discuss the whole thing about siddhis and powers and all that stuff, and gurus and that all coming up, coming attractions. At the moment, though, the only question about that story is, was he doing anything? And the answer from my understanding of him is no, he wasn't. That was just happening. He was allowing it to happen, or he was the vehicle through which it was happening. It's like Krishna. Now, I'm not saying that Maharaji's in the avataric space or anything, but Krishna, in this case, comes and becomes a charioteer. And as a charioteer, he's talking to Arjuna, and he's bringing about all this stuff. He's acting just like another person, and he's got a few powers he's manifesting now and then. Right? But he's doing all of that. All of that's happening within the laws of nature, and none of that is outside the laws. He is just resting tranquil behind it all. As you are going to find out, God rests tranquil behind all of this. Creating it, yet not involved in it. It all coming out of him, yet not doing it. And when you are around such beings, you begin to sense that though the thing is being done, you don't seem to see, just like you expect. If you're quiet enough, you can't seem to find somebody in there doing it, which is incredibly exasperating. Right? The question is, I said a few lectures back that there wasn't anybody I particularly cared if I ever saw again. How do I deal with my needs in relation to that? Well, in the way that my work is evolving, whether or not a need is satisfied or not is equally interesting. So that I find myself less and less creating an environment in order to make sure a certain need is satisfied. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And I kept thinking that certain needs would have to be fulfilled or all hell would break loose. And then they weren't, and it didn't. Right? Like I lived in India in certain ways that were very different than we live in the West. And I thought I would never have been able to do that, and I did it, and it was okay. And I found out that fasting was okay, even food. You know? And there were even times when I was doing pranayama when I actually got to the place where I wasn't breathing. That was a far-out one, speaking of needs. You know. Now the social needs like affection or things like that, when I'm lonely, which I still get, far out, isn't that interesting? Not, I got to get rid of this loneliness. Interesting. When I'm not lonely, interesting. See? It's the same place. That's what's so far out about it. There's a certain equanimity that develops so that whether you're getting it or not getting it doesn't make a hell of a lot of difference. That's where you're getting towards the place. One to me is loss and gain. One to me is pleasure and pain. One to me is fame and shame. That's where you get when you're finished. The moment, it all isn't all one to me, believe me. But when it isn't, it's interesting because it shows to me where I'm holding, where my stash of attachment is. Okay? So that if I'm lonely, I say, oh, I still want something far out. Look at that. He's still lurking in there. Isn't that interesting? See? All the time I thought that was gone, you know? You know, like sometimes I go, like as I said, a year ago when I went into seclusion, I spent all the time looking at television and drinking beer and collecting. Then this year I went in thinking, I'm never going to be able to handle this, but I really want to go off by myself. And 6 weeks later, I had to say, well, you really ought to go back out now. Not out of, God, I've done it, now I can get out. You know? I mean, what happened to me this year was so incredibly different from 6 years ago. I was in the temple, and Bhagwan Das was coming and going, and I was there sort of alone a lot. And every day, I would be alone a great deal, and every day the bus would come by the outside on the road that went to Nainital, and then there'd be another bus that would go to Delhi, and then I could get the plane to go to California. And I had a plane ticket. And I was the sadhu, you know, and I would take out my plane ticket out of my shoulder bag and my passport, and I'd go over with my nose pressed to the window, watching the bus each day. It was like a ritual. It was this horrible ritual thing. And each day I would have this fantasy of, I don't have to stay here. I'll write a note and say I've been called away, and I will, you know. And in 3 days I could be dancing in the Fillmore. See? I could take acid and I could, oh, wow, far out, and I'll be doing, and I don't have to stay here, and so that'll be interesting too. Okay? And then as I said before, I think to you, I'd get the fantasy all the way to the Fillmore, and I'd be dancing in the Fillmore, and then what? And then, and we'd be making love, and it would be all exquisite, and then I'd think to myself, now I'm making love after dancing in the Fillmore, I'd think to myself, you know where I really wish I was now? In a temple in the Himalayas. See? And then I'd put the ticket away for the next day. And I was dealing each day with those desires where there wasn't any need to fulfill them. All I had to do was keep recognizing and not make believe I didn't have them. Right? Honesty is a great asset in the spiritual journey. Question. The question is, would I talk about the Krishna consciousness movement in relation to what we're doing here? As I said to you at the beginning of the first course, the Bhagavad Gita is one of the most extensively commentaried and interpreted Gitas. And of those commentaries, one of them is that done by Swami A.C. Bhaktivedanta. And I have some 24 commentaries on the Gita, including some that are absolutely exquisitely scholarly in terms of the Sanskrit meanings of words in the shlokas. And I have, in preparing each of these lectures, prepared them from maybe at least 8 or 9 different commentaries which reflect the different ways of looking at the Gita. I think it would be naive now to think that any Gita is the right Gita, that Gitas have come at the time and place that are suitable with certain interpretations. And it is I think that in these lectures you will find that we are at some times going well beyond the Penguin edition. The reason I use the Penguin edition is because I felt it was the most comfortable and harmonious and generally valid one for our work at this point. Not that it's any better than Swami Bhaktivedanta's or any other. And in fact, the aspect that Swami Bhaktivedanta is concerned about, which we are going to be dealing with as we get into the devotional aspects of this course, will get a good hearing. There is no need to be concerned if for the Krishna consciousness people. What the Krishna consciousness movement is arguing is that devotion to Krishna is the only path that is suitable at this time. And that is not in the Gita. That is an interpretation of the Gita. Because as you are seeing from, as we go through this, and from, I can assure you that if you study all of the other commentaries, including Shankara and Ramanuja and Zainer and Aurobindo and on and on and on and on, people equally as scholarly as Swami Bhaktivedanta and equally as devotional, you will find that Krishna advocates a number of different yogas in the Bhagavad Gita. But the movement concerns itself with one primarily. And as such, it is a valid movement. I think anybody that says something is the only way, whether it's Christ or worshiping Krishna, is insecure in their faith. Okay. Questions? Yes. The question is stated, I think, is I find that I'm not sure whether when I'm looking to see what my dharma is, I'm merely not defining territorial prerogatives or territorial boundaries for who I am. And if such, if that is what I'm doing, how do I go about really finding my dharma, right? The predicament is, until you are no longer attached to your ego, every act you do is going to have your ego in it. There's not a chance it won't. Right up until the end, there is going to be subtle ways in which you're going to be doing it to yourself over and over again. That's what's so beautiful about the battle. You just get to the point where you just did this method and you got all... and then suddenly there's a little ego trip about it. Like, look at my right? See? And you keep doing that thing. The ego is very exquisitely subtle about this. And what I've said about finding one's dharma at the stage we're at, or the spiritual path, I've said that the length of the steps is about one body length. You get up and you take one step and you fall flat on your face. Because it was another impure trip. And then you pull yourself up to where your head was, and you listen for the next route, and you take the next step, and you fall flat in your face again. And that's about the rate at which we go. See? There is very little likelihood that you're going to hear the pure message. Right? You're just going to hear another, but you're going to keep tuning and tuning and tuning through study, through meditation, through falling on your face, etc. You'll keep noticing your ego define the territory. You'll keep breaking out, creating a new one, breaking out, creating a new one. And then slowly, slowly, as the methods start to work, your attachment starts to get less and less to the whole business. And the ego only works as long as you think it, you are it, doing its thing just like your senses. It's just a functional entity. I have a nice personality. I think it's lovely. I am sure it'll stay around. I don't see why it should go anywhere. I don't happen to be that who that is, but that's okay. It's a nice personality. You know, it's just like this is a beautiful shirt, I think. I'm not caught being a purple shirt at the moment. But it's a nice shirt. Yes. Mm-hmm. He absolutely is. And that's what I was saying to you, was that at the lowest level of doing the Dharma, of doing my duty, it's what's known as the sattvic trap. See, I don't want to anticipate too much, but we are going to talk about the gunas, the three strands of the rope of nature. And one of the strands is sattva, or the strand that brings one towards the light. It's the good guy-ness, if you want to do it in a cheap, shoddy definition. The good guy-ness. And what you can do is use that good guy-ness to get you out of the other two gunas. And that good guy-ness, you can become so good. There are many yogis in India that are incredibly good. They do everything spit and polish right down the line. They are absolutely purely Vedic. Every ritual is just right on. And if you say to them, you did that wrong, they'll freak completely because they are totally attached to being good. And at the lowest level of the game of starting this journey of awakening, the thing you're advised to do is do your duty. And the reason you do your duty is to be a good guy, is to become good in the system. It's the sattvic trap. And he's working from within sattva to work on Arjuna, because that's who Arjuna is at this moment. But also Krishna is feeding in this other wisdom, which is going to extricate him from sattva as well as from the other gunas. Do you understand what I said? Okay. Yeah. And this question was in a book that came out in Europe that was unfortunately titled Doing Your Own Being, which has since come out in America as The Only Dance There Is. I said something about meditating with mantra, and do I still do it, and if not, how did I get rid of it? You don't get rid of methods. You don't get rid of methods. They just sort of fall away. I've sat through sometimes like a 10-day meditation course where I couldn't get rid of a mantra for the whole 10 days. Right? It just was sitting there, even though I couldn't get, you know, I was trying to get rid of it. And other times, I just go into another method, and I just go into the method, and it's gone. The mantra's gone. Right? So I tend to be very compassionate with myself. I tend not to demand, I'm not a schedule feeding type person. I'm more of a demand feeding. So that I respond to the flow of things. And when the mantra's around, I work with it. And when it isn't around, I do something else. I'm a really schlock sadhak in that sense. You know, it's not 8 to 10 I work with mantra, 10 to 12 I don't. Right? The mantra may be around for a month or so, and then it's an old dead mantra. At which point, sometimes my intuition will say, ah, it's old and dead, work with it. And sometimes my intuition will say, it's old and dead, leave it.